Coming up today on episode 78 of In the Front Row with Mike Vaccaro, we go Winter Olympics and we talk with Devin Harris. Harris, part of the very first Jamaican bobsled team. He tells us about his journey from the ghetto in Kingston, Jamaica, all the way to Calgary for the 1988 Olympics. Bobsledding, never thought it was going to be in his blood. It certainly is now. He also talks about the 1993 movie Cool Runnings, loosely based on that 1988 team. And also what he did in a couple of Olympics after that, and what he's doing now as a motivational speaker and giving back to his native Jamaica. Our episode today, episode 78, it features Devin Harris from the Jamaican bobsled team. Well, Devin, thanks so much for joining us here today. Excited to hear about your story that some people know about, obviously, with a big movie back in the 1990s. We're going to talk about that as well. But let's get into how things started for you. You were born in Kingston, Jamaica, grew up there, and I know it wasn't the best of places for you. Describe what it was like for you growing up, those early days in the 60s and 70s in Kingston, Jamaica.
Yeah, man. So I grew up, believe it or not, Mike, in Olympic Gardens in Kingston. So people go, wow, that's a fitting place for a future Olympian to have grown up. But Olympic Gardens was also a tough environment, you know, violent, impoverished. I just remember, especially in the early 70s, early to mid 70s, as the political violence started to increase and it got kind of intensified around about the late 70s to 80s when I was a teenager. A little bit fearful, I have to say, but the thing that kind of, I guess, gave me some direction, one was school. I absolutely love school. Not because I was a Rhodes Scholar or anything. I just, that's a place where I could play, man. And that's where I discovered sports. First loving sports was soccer, and then I ended up running track. But those things just kind of kept me grounded, plus just dreaming of, you know, I wanted eventually to compete in the Olympics, but more importantly, I wanted to be an army officer. So just having those dreams, even in that challenging environment, kept me grounded, kept me focused.
And did you see friends, family members that maybe didn't make it out of that, but you did?
You know, so you look back now and, you know, I go back to the old neighborhood every now and again. I have a charity that definitely takes me back. And it's kind of amazing. You know, I've been around the world a little bit. And in the same time that I've been around the world, many of those guys have just been around the block. And it's a kind of the normal story, you know, some are dead, some are in prison, and then the others are just there. And I wouldn't even call it living. I look at them and I wonder how they're existing, because, you know, it's hard, very difficult for me to imagine myself being in that environment all these years, not moving forward.
I saw one of the speaking engagements that you had, and you talked about a lamppost. There was a lamppost there, and it was a very important one in your development. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, man. So, you know, it was admittedly the way before iPad and YouTube and all that stuff. And so when I was at home as a teenager, there was a lamppost just outside my gate. And I would just, that was my hangout spot, man. I've never used this term before, but that was my dreaming post. Because from that lamppost, I had a really good view of Forest Hills, which was, you know, maybe 5 miles away as a crow flies, but, you know, up on the hill, land with big, beautiful mansions. And I would just kind of stand there and dream about living in a different environment, clearly, but doing some special things in life. And yeah, that was my spot.
And again, sports, as you said, was an outlet for you. Soccer, you ran track as well. How much playing those sports were you thinking of an Olympic dream in the Summer Olympics?
The Olympic dream got birthed in 1979. I was 15 years old. That's the first year I started running track seriously. And it clearly was the year before the Summer Olympics in Moscow, Idaho. Oh, Jesus. Moscow, Russia. There's a Moscow, Idaho.
There is.
And, you know, one of our teammates, Chris Stokes, actually attended school in Moscow, Idaho. But no, this was this was Moscow, USSR at the time. And ABC Wild World of Sports had this series called Road to Moscow, and they highlighted athletes from around the world, different disciplines and so on. But the thing that struck me, you know how when you think of an Olympic athlete, you think of the superhuman being. And what I saw in that series was how average and ordinary these people were. They're just like you and I, Mike, you know, normal lives with just a ton load of challenges, trying to get to the Olympics, but at the same time, trying to deal with all these other issues in their lives. And it kind of hit me that Olympic athletes were very average and ordinary people with extraordinary dreams and an equally strong desire to make those dreams come true. And that, you know, inspired me to want to be an Olympian. And I started training like a madman since then, you know, thinking, yes, that I was going to, you know, unfortunately, I'm from Jamaica, man, where everybody sprints fast. And guess what? I wasn't one of them. So I started running middle distances, 800, 1500 meters. And I started dreaming of competing in the Olympic Games in those events. And, you know, as fate would have it, I didn't. But I think I would argue that I did something a little cooler. So definitely colder.
Yeah, that was 1984, the Olympics. Unfortunately, you missed out on that. But then you went to the prestigious Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, in England. What was the timeline there to get there? And how did you get there from Kingston, Jamaica?
Yeah, so I graduated high school in 84, actually, which would have been the year of the Olympics. And you talk about just being, you know, crazily ambitious. I wanted to be a high school athlete who represented Jamaica at the Olympic Games. At the time, I thought no high school athlete had ever represented Jamaica, but I think I'm wrong on that. And in that year, there were two guys, Raymond Stewart and Gregory Magoo, who ended up winning medals as part of our 4x1 team. So I graduated from high school and then I enlisted in the Army. I started training that December of 84, yes. I enlisted as an officer. So you go through this whole 3-day selection process, and then you go through basic training where they, you know, they just drive you into the ground, man. Horrible, miserable 18 weeks, but hey, you know, there's a price to pay, right? So we in Jamaica didn't have this little Boston Tea Party thing like you guys did here in the US. So we're a part of the Commonwealth. So, you know, our education system, our laws, our military doctrine are all based on the British system. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that the Jamaica Defense Force does, which is the organization I joined and enlisted in as an officer, is that they send their officers to the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, for training, some other places as well. So I was, you know, fortunate to make it through this tough selection process, did basic training, and then went off to Sandhurst, which was really like my number one dream. I wanted to be in the Olympics for sure, but these days I describe the Olympics as my side hustle. Right? Being in the Army was a thing that drove me, that I was most passionate about. It, in my mind, was a thing that was going to, becoming an officer was going to get me out of the ghetto like yesterday, right? So that was my dream.
And was it difficult in a transition that you had to go from, as you said, the ghetto to that military academy?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man, on so many different levels, dude. You know, so that was the first time I'm ever leaving Jamaica. Yeah, you know, so I'm from a country that's 98% black to where I'm in an environment that is practically, you know, all white, like 99% white. You know, it's like trying to adjust to that. You know, and yes, going from the middle of the hood to the most prestigious military training school in the world, it's like, you know, adjusting to that. The thing that I would say made it easier and kept me focused was the reason why I was there in the first place, to become an Army officer, right? So, you know, it's welcome to life. There are, you know, every single time we have a goal, they're just going to be a whole new set of circumstances, a whole new environment that we have to adapt to and adapt to ourselves to make ourselves comfortable in order to get through that process. And so, yeah, that was kind of, you know, what I did at Sandhurst.
Were there sports there at the academy? Did that help with your transition at all?
I ran track very late in my time. Actually, after I become an officer, during my basic training, no, I was busy, man, trying to get this officer thing going.
Well, September 1987, I believe it was, the idea of a Jamaican bobsled team started to come about. Mm-hmm. And when did you hear about this? I heard it was one of your colonels that kind of pushed you toward this opportunity. But what was your first thought when you thought Jamaica and bobsled?
Yeah, so it was that summer of 87. I'm reading, you know, this, we call it the Force Orders. It's a newsletter, essentially, more important, though. And it said something about those who are interested in undergoing dangerous and rigorous training to compete in the Winter Olympics in Calgary. Never heard of Calgary before. But they should let themselves be known. And I'm like, what? Bobsled team? All I knew about bobsledding was that it was a winter sport. It was fast. It was dangerous. And then I'm thinking, but the Olympics, like, it's August. You know, the Olympics are in February. How in the world are you going to train a team in Jamaica? And I remember thinking, this has to be the most absurd, ridiculous idea ever conceived by a man. And I punctuated that. Us young officers were having this conversation about this new idea. And I go, nobody could ever get me to go on one of those things. And then one day my colonel is passing my office and he goes, Devon, I tell Colonel Barnes that you're going off for the bobsled team trials. Oh, yes, sir. And it's kind of in that moment. Well, you know, I'm going. It's like there's no debate. I am going to the team trials. And man, the way I'm wired, I could have gone and then just kind of go through the motions and say, yes, sir, I went to the team trials. I didn't get selected. But now that I was going, the way I'm wired is like, man, I have to make the team. And I had no idea how I was going to make this team. You know, at that time, I would consider myself sports fit, army fit. I could walk 100 miles with 50 pounds on my back and a rifle in my hand. But I hadn't really done any real sports training up to that point. But, I just went and I tried hard. And I think they liked my smile. I think that's what it was.
It's better to try hard. You had the fastest push time. So is that where your track experience came into play? Because we've seen that, you know, other athletes that have kind of made that switch to the bobsled, and it seems like their speed is what certainly helps them out.
Yeah, you know, so, dude, I was trying so hard. We had all these sprint tests, right, it's speed and explosive tests. And clearly I'm not the fastest guy there. And I'm fighting to be, like, in the top four. And then it came down to the push. And although I didn't know anything about bobsledding, I'm like, this has to be the most important test. And I don't know. I pulled it off. I ended up, the speed and athletic talent is important. Don't get me wrong. But as I heard a British coach, bobsled coach, once said, you know, a good dose of aggression we'll do the trick. And I just blasted, man. I was just like a beast on that push test. And yes, ended up pushing faster than even the fastest sprinter that was there.
So it's a four-man bobsled team. Where are you in those four when you're getting started?
We actually, which most people don't recognize, started as two-man teams. And I was a break man. And then on the four-man, when we just started out, I was the break man. I was a guy on the back. Now, here's a story that most people don't know. In 88, we were not entered in the four-man bobsled event. We decided to do it at the Olympic Games. And Chris Stokes, the guy who attended college in Moscow, Idaho, he had come to the Olympics to watch his brother, Dudley, race, and we recruited him that week. And so I gave up my spot on the very back as a brakeman because it's easiest. That's the easiest part of the set to get onto. And push from the right side. So I ended up being the number two guy in the sled behind the driver, Dudley.
So I guess the question, you're in Jamaica, you're getting ready, you're training. How are you doing it? How are you training in Jamaica for a winter sport like the bobsled?
It's easy, man. You know, you import some snow. No, so here's the thing. I know it's, you know, when people think of Jamaica, a tropical environment, and a sport like bobsled, they initially can't see the correlation. Well, if athletes in temperate climate countries, right, they have summers and they have to train. So what do they do in the summer? They lift weights, they run, they do sprinting, they get fit, and then they do what we call push training on a sled on wheels. Mm-hmm. Just so happens that we have summer all year round in Jamaica. And granted, we didn't have all that long of a time before the Olympic Games, but that's what we were doing essentially. You know, going to the gym, and we had a makeshift sled on wheels on the army base, and we would push this thing on a flat concrete surface. 3 hours every afternoon during the week, 6 hours in a Saturday morning, that's what we did.
Part of the bobsled, obviously, is the track and how you deal with the turns. So how are you training for that?
Nobody does that. So the bobsledding can only be done on a bobsled track. So if you're an American athlete, you're doing what we do in Jamaica. And then it's only in the fall, around about, you know, as early as mid-October, some of the tracks are open. But, you know, November, really, for most people, that they actually get on a bobsled track to learn and practice how to drive the turns. So from that perspective, we were right there with everyone, you know. You know, give or take, you know, 100 years that some of experience and history that some teams had, and the money and the sled. But, you know, everything has worked out or panned out.
Bobsledding is not for the faint of heart. I mean, you guys are wearing helmets for a reason. Did you ever consider how dangerous of a sport it was or is?
You don't. When you're doing those things, you don't. It's funny you brought that up, because I remember very early in the day, I was watching a video with my dad, and he sat there in silence. And then he goes, "But Deb, this thing is really dangerous." And I go, "Yeah, Daddy, that's why we wear a helmet, right?" You know, and I say it often, and it's true. When you push off the top of that hill, there's no guarantee that 55 seconds later you'll be alive. But you don't think about that. You know, you're thinking about doing your best, getting as fast a time, trying to win the race, you know, and really living in the moment, especially as a driver.
As you said, this is a crazy, crazy idea. What was the reaction in Jamaica? What was the reaction of other bobsledders when you got to Calgary, as this is the Jamaican bobsled team?
Yeah, it's not as people thought or saw portrayed in the movie, actually. Certainly, you know, when we went to Canada. I think the first, we were disappointed when we got to Canada, because we thought we were the only black guys in Canada. Bobsledding. And then we got there and saw the Canadian team, and they had two black guys on the team. And then to make things worse, one of them was of Jamaican descent. I'm like, darn it. You know, but people just kind of just took us for what it was, you know, just a bunch of athletes who were starting the sport. I think they were thinking, well, at least we know we're going to beat them. You know, that's what I would be thinking if I were in their shoe. But, you know, look, we're Jamaicans, man. You know, we are cool, if I must say so myself. So people just kind of gravitated to us. And we were just there learning, trying to learn and soak things up and compete as best as we could. And, you know, athletes know when another athlete is talented or is working hard. Right. And they definitely saw that in us, just busting it. And then you start to see some results, not crazy results, but results, and they respected that.
Jamaican team, it was a U.S. coach, though, right? Howard Seiler, who was your head coach, a former bobsledder as well himself. What was that experience like having him coach you guys and become the bobsledders that you were?
Yeah, Howard was a cool. Howard was a salesman, man, and he could talk your ears off. but, you know, it was really important that we had someone who had been there and done it. And for me, more than the technical stuff, because quite frankly, we learned more of the technical stuff from others, was the mental side of the game. And Howard, that was where his big focus was on, was, you know, talking to us just about the mindset. Because bobsledding is, I guess you could say that about most sports, all sports at a very high level. A lot of it is a mental game, the psychological piece. And we had lots of conversation around that.
What did he do to have you guys trust him? Again, crazy idea, dangerous idea as well. How did he gain your trust and belief? And if you listen to him, you were going to have success.
You know, I think it's, I would call it blind trust. It's the kind of thing that you have to have at the very beginning of any team. You know, when I started out as a brakeman, I was climbing in a sled behind a guy who had never driven a sled before. You know, and you just have to trust blindly that he's going to take me down to the bottom of the track and I'll be alive. So from that perspective, you can see how it would be even easier to trust Howard because he had done it. He had competed in the 1980 Winter Olympic Games in Lake Placid, finished fifth for the U.S., which was until 2002 the highest finish the U.S. had enjoyed in those events. So, yeah, he came with experience. He came with credibility.
Again, you guys were the talk of that 88 Olympics in Calgary. Were you guys, was it like being a superstar? Did you get a lot of attention from the media, from the fans when you were there?
Yeah, and it's a double-edged sword, Mike, because, you know, I'm the kind of guy who, when I'm competing, I like to stay in my lane and just really focus on what I'm doing and not talk about, you know, to other people what I'm trying to achieve or what I'm doing. And, you know, clearly, if you're in the press, that's what it's, oh, what do you guys hope to achieve? And I did not like that part. But I also realized, of, because I understand psychology a little bit more, that every time we spoke to them about what it is that we're trying to do, we're reinforcing that. But it was a little distracting, I have to. It's again, a double-edged sword, right? It's flattering, you know, getting all this attention, distracting as well.
Was it a plus, though, to be able to promote Jamaica? I mean, obviously, you see what somebody like Usain Bolt did as well during his time in the Olympics, but were you helping kind of promote the country as a whole and what Jamaica was about beyond, you know, what people think as vacation places and all that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, that's definitely one of those pluses, one of those is unexpected, it's not even consequences, but benefits from having a team like ours. I mean, as Jamaicans, all of us are very, very proud of our little island. And, you know, having us being in an environment that is so alien to Jamaica, and not just being there, man, but actually competing and, you know, kicking some ass, if I may say so myself, because that's just how we roll as Jamaicans, you know, and then just seeing the attention that brought to our country, the positive attention, was definitely a plus.
1993, the Disney movie Cool Runnings came out. People know that. John Candy playing the head coach. And loosely based on your experience, were you involved with that movie at all?
loosely. You know,
very loosely.
There's a lot about Quranians that you need to add the word loosely to. Like when it says based on the story of the true story of the Jamaica bobsled, just loosely based on the true story, right? So
you never went into a freezer to get ready for Calgary.
Oh, sorry. Sorry to disappoint you folks. No, that doesn't make any sense whatsoever, actually. But we spent a lot of time speaking with the writers, and I remember them taking copious notes. And I imagined that after we left the room, they go, "What a load of crap. Let me write something interesting," you know? Because they took a lot of poetic licensing, a lot of liberties with the movie. And then it took about 5 years to film. And so every 6 months or so, I'll hear, "Oh, they're filming. Oh, they're not filming." And then eventually I got a call in January 93 or thereabout, could be February, and they're filming in Calgary. Would you like to be on the set? And I'm like, absolutely. So I was on the set. I hung out with met all the actors, of course, and I hung out with the stunt guys and really didn't do much, you know? So that's why I said loosely involved.
Did it at least, though, heighten, again, your team, your experience, and again, bring it maybe more to the masses, even more so than the 88 Olympics maybe did?
Oh, yeah, on so many different levels. You know, when I think about the sport of bobsledding itself, right? Like, name one other movie about bobsledding. There's none, right? So it brought that attention and notoriety to the sport and inspired generations beyond bobsled, beyond 88, and attracting them to bobsledding, but attracting them to winter sports in general, people who under normal circumstances would not be considering that. And then, of course, we spoke about Jamaica. It brought this additional attention to our country as well. And then it immortalized our story. If we had won a medal in 88 and there was no movie, I don't know that we would still be as remembered as we are now, thanks to Cool Runnings.
And as you said, you started out as a two-man team, and you had Olympic experiences as a two-man team in 1992 in France, 98 in Nagano, Japan as well. What were those experiences like, especially going off of, you know, the first experience in 88? Now, it had to be a little bit different, I would think, in 92 and 98.
Oh, yeah, man. You know, driving a bobsled, can I say it's fun? It's just so much fun. a lot more work, as you can imagine. There's the driving is far more involved than just being a brakeman. It requires a lot more mental preparation and expending a lot more mental energy. It's... I guess you could describe, in a way, I draw the analogy to a quarterback on a football team. The pressure is on you to produce. But dude, I live for those moments, and I want that on my shoulder. And so, especially in 92, the first time around, was amazing, you know, for me. And, you know, getting, a decent result, and then I was actually away from the sport for about 4 years and then coming back. And I would argue that Nagano 98 was the most difficult of the three Olympics to qualify for me. And then to go there with having overcome all those challenges and finishing 29th from 42, no coaching, the best finish we ever had up to that point was very gratifying.
And you're talking about the danger of this sport and the tracks. I guess no two tracks are similar, right? So How important is it to make those practice runs and learn what that track is all about and learn what you need to do? And then how much it has to be in your memory? Okay, the turn's coming here, a turn's coming there.
Well, you better learn that track. Otherwise, there's a strong likelihood that you're not going to get down the track, let alone be competitive, right? So yeah, the first order of business is to learn which directions the turns go. This one go left, this one go right. And then once you have that down, it's really about you know, getting onto the finer details on how to drive each turn. Although every track is different, there are turns that are similar from one track to the next. And so you can go, I'm thinking out loud, like corner 7 in Calgary is similar to, you know, another track in Nagano, let's say. And so because you have done that before, you can, you know. But yeah, it comes, you learn the track, and it's key that you learn the track, not just for safe to say, but for to be competitive. Because if you can't be thinking, there's a lot of what I describe as conditional reflex that happens in bobsledding. You can't be thinking about what you need to do. You just know, and you react to it. And that's from studying the track and then mentally visualizing it, practicing it in your mind, like, you know, as many times as you possibly can.
Yeah, you got milliseconds to make those decisions because you're going down so fast. So, mm-hmm. Again, 98 was the last time you were at the Olympics. What happened after that? Did you kind of retire? And what's going through your mind during that time? The, you know, the high of being on this team, being on the first, you know, four-man team, and then a couple more Olympics after that. What was that transition like in your life?
Yeah, you know, so I gave away my bobsled suit for a business suit, and I started speaking. Well, maybe that's not entirely true, because when I started speaking, people asked me to speak in my bobsled uniform, which I did for a number of years, and then I outgrew it, you know what I mean? I kind of made that transition. It on one level, it's very difficult. I remember being at the Olympics in Salt Lake City, and I was in a way the most difficult one for me, because I'm there watching guys I used to beat and thinking, there's no reason for me not to be in this race, right? Because it's still in my blood. Fortunately, you know, I've recovered. I'm a recovering bobsledder. and I'm focused on speaking and, you know, writing books. I've written a couple of books, and I have a charity as well. So my energies are put towards those activities.
Yeah, you found the Keep On Pushing Foundation. What can you tell us about that and the impact that that has had?
Yeah, man. So back in 06, I went back to the old neighborhood, went to my old elementary school, and I was speaking to the principal, asking him about the biggest challenge he was having. And it was that many of the kids were coming to school hungry. And we all know, you know, if you're hungry, you can't learn. If you can't learn, then you don't get educated, you don't become a productive member of society. And that's, you know, a huge negative, especially in an environment, in a neighborhood like the one I'm from. So the foundation, we got that started, and we started supporting a breakfast program, a school supplies program. I just got back from Jamaica. We, first day of school, each child at that school and another in the old neighborhood got a book bag with school supplies and so on. Back in 2021, we completed the building of a wellness center, which was timely because it allowed the school to be open partially during COVID. Nice. And we just established a computer lab there. And the goal is to continue to develop more of those, not just for the students in the school, but to, after school, on weekends, to provide digital training for the young people in the communities as well, to, you know, teach a man how to fish.
Yeah, you live in New York now, but so how often do you get back to Jamaica?
A few times a year. You know, I'm you know, it's a little bit hot there, so. I get back a couple of different ways. One is through companies in North America who hire me to go to speak there. And I'm like, all right, if I have to, I will. And so I'll go. And sometimes I'll use those trips to go visit my elementary school in Kingston, or I'll make a special trip as I just did in September.
So what's your reaction like when you go back? You know, are you still kind of very, very known, very popular in Jamaica?
Nobody knows me, man. When I competed, I was wearing a helmet. and I didn't have the Usain Bolt thing going on. No, it's kind of interesting because it does come up sometimes, and people are As I said, September, I was in Jamaica, I was in Ocho Rios. And I brought my family along as well for this trip, and we went to the school and all that good stuff, but we're in Ocho Rios buying gifts for friends back here. And I were in the store and the guy goes, "You stand up like you're a soldier." And I'm like, "Yeah, I used to be in the army." And then we started talking, and then the whole bobsled thing came up. And he said, like, "Hey, this is a legend. This is a legend." You know, but outside of that, you know, unless I end up in a conversation with someone just in that direction, nobody knows who I am.
So you're more famous than Usain Bolt then?
Well, you know, that would be stretching it. That sounds like a line from Cool Runnings.
loosely, right?
Yes.
Well, again, you've had great success, motivational speaker. You've got a website as well. How can people follow you and maybe contact you if they want to have you speak to them? Because, again, you've got a great story, a great message as well. How can people, again, tap into what Devon Harris is doing?
Yeah, man, easy. DevonHarris.com is a website. DevonHarris.com. My email is easy to Devon@DevonHarris.com, or, you know, on Instagram, I'm official Devon Harris. Facebook, you can find me there. Keep on pushing with Devon Harris. I claim I'm the easiest guy to find. Just type in Devon Harris Jamaica and I come up.
Do you still go to the Winter Olympics? Are you still, you know, involved at all with what's happening with the Olympic sports these days?
So, between 2014 and 2018, I actually single-handedly ran the Jamaican program. I've kind of stepped back from that a little bit so I can focus on some other things. But I've had a good fortune of going to a few. I was in Vancouver and Sochi and in Pyeongchang as well, just working. Which, is a better feeling now than 2002 or when I was there working and missing it. You know, now yeah. It's like, now I can actually enjoy it. You know, go to other events and just kind of be a spectator and enjoy the Olympic experience.
By running, do you mean coaching? You were coaching at that time, the teams?
Not coaching, but administering. Okay. You know, selecting teams, planning training, hiring coaches, that kind of stuff.
So bobsled is something that you never thought was going to be part of your life, but it's in your blood, it sounds like.
It's the thing that movies are made of, isn't it?
Certainly is, even if they're loosely based on that. Devon, can't thank you enough. This is a great story, again, to dive more into this. Obviously, a lot of people know about the Jamaican bobsled team, but to hear it from you is even more amazing. And I can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here today.
Hey, Mike, thanks for having me, man. Appreciate you.
Well, great stuff there from Devon Harris. And now you know the real story of that Jamaican bobsled team, maybe not what you saw in the movie Cool Runnings. And be sure to check out his website, devonharris.com, for more information on him or if you're looking for a motivational speaker. As always, we thank you for watching and listening and invite you to subscribe, to like, and to share, as we'll have more great episodes coming your way soon. For our creator, director, producer, J.R. Quitman, I'm Mike Vaccaro. We'll see you next time for another edition of In the Front Row with Mike Vaccaro. Have a great day, everybody.